You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Before launching a major assault on Iraq, the U.S. warmakers scrambled for a rationale that might win them the support of the American people. A totally manufactured story that Iraqi soldiers occupying Kuwait had thrown premature infants out of their incubators did the trick for then U.S. President Bush 1. The invasion of Afghanistan was not motivated to save infants, but supposedly the girls and women of that country. Noble purpose and hypocrisy are the ever-present twins of imperial war-making. So it's no surprise to find these twins present in the NATO invasion of Libya. To explore the complexities that help make this trick work better and the hypocrisies that underlie it, I'm joined in the studio by Derek O'Keefe. Derek is an author. His latest book, Michael Ignatieff, The Lesser Evil, will soon be released. And Derek also is co-chair of the Canadian Peace Alliance. Good morning, Derek. Welcome again to Red Eye.
Good morning. Thanks. It's good to be here again.
Let's start with the propaganda used to support NATO war making in Libya and the ways it was able to gather some popular support. Do you think the sweep of popular revolt across North Africa and the Middle East, what we refer to as the Arab Spring, was used by the war makers to their advantage?
Oh, absolutely. And it was, sort of served up for them on a platter in a way, I think, because the configuration of events and some of the forces that were calling for intervention, or at least the voices that we heard calling for intervention from Libya, were speaking ostensibly on behalf of an uprising that many people sympathized with. Many people had stood in solidarity with similar uprisings starting at the beginning of this year with Tunisia and then Egypt. And having seen those regimes driven out, there was, additional uprisings inspired by Egypt and Tunisia spread, and I think many of us hoped that regime after regime would fall. Perhaps we were a little too optimistic in those early days of the Arab Spring. And I definitely think that U.S. and British, French, Canadian imperialism and NATO in general seized on this moment and portrayed themselves as a savior in the case of Libya, and under the guise of going in to implement a no-fly zone, really have gone in with a full-scale effort at regime change and possibly much more. We know now that there are special forces on the ground. There are all sorts of corporate interests and oil to be had by the conquering powers that have assisted the rebels. So the story of Libya is certainly not over. In this intervention, there'll be likely a lot of pressure to deepen the NATO intervention, and so still a lot of work and a lot of opportunity for us, I believe, to unite a broader movement against further NATO intervention in Libya. I don't think the game is played out at all.
You mentioned Libyans themselves calling for assistance and help from outside the country. That was true at demonstrations you were involved in organizing here in support of the popular movement in Libya, as you had organized them in relation to Egypt and Tunisia. But this was the first time, actually, that anyone in the Arab world revolting had called for uprising. And I notice now that there's some noises in the aftermath of NATO intervention in Libya coming from Syria, calling for some foreign presence, not initially NATO, but they've said that's a possibility too.
Certainly, and it's a very concerning thing and a trend we have to be vigilant about. But I think it is important to emphasize that the call, which again was coming from some segments of the uprising, we really can't say for sure what proportion of the people who were involved in this uprising against Gaddafi supported this call, although it did become prominent. But what they were specifically asking for was a no-fly zone to provide, you know, to sort of knock out the advantage Gaddafi had of his air force. And let's be very clear that the Gaddafi regime didn't do any of us any favors and had been brutalizing the Libyan people for many years. I mean, they did send fighter jets to bomb Benghazi after the initial uprising. There were clearly massacres of unarmed demonstrators in Libya. There were a lot of crimes being committed. As well, it's worth noting that I remember quite clearly Gaddafi urging the Tunisians to hold off their uprising and saying that Ben Ali was the only one who should rule Tunisia. So, of course, Libya, we remember the geography, it's right between Tunisia to the west and Egypt on the east. It's right in the middle of these two other uprisings. And Gaddafi, from the beginning, obviously felt threatened by this, and so he extended his solidarity to his neighboring dictators. And people remembered that, and they were very determined to take him out. So all of these factors played in, I think, to some Libyan voices calling for a no-fly zone. But right from the very beginning, both in that resolution, Resolution 1373 at the UN, and then after the resolution, the aggressive NATO powers went far beyond the so-called no-fly zone. Phyllis Bennis did a very good critique of that initial UN resolution, saying it wasn't a resolution for a no-fly zone, it was a resolution for war. Even if you go just by the letter of that UN resolution, it's been flagrantly violated basically from the beginning by France, the UK, Canada, the US, and others striking at Gaddafi's homes and compounds, clearly targeting members of his regime. So right from the beginning and right up to now in some of the remaining Gaddafi strongholds, such as the village of Sirte, there's ongoing NATO bombardment of those towns that everyone admits in those towns there is support for Gaddafi and amongst certain tribes and so forth. But, you know, nothing is being said about the NATO bombardment of these civilian populations, which is what is still ongoing. And we're talking up to 50,000 dead now on all sides. That's a figure that has been estimated by the Transitional National Council, so by the rebel forces. So this is a huge number of casualties, and we don't know how many are directly caused by NATO. But we do know that the course of events that really was unleashed by the intervention has led to tens of thousands of deaths. And I don't think this human toll is being discussed at all seriously enough.
Well, that's certainly a major hypocrisy in the whole thing, the pretense that they're protecting civilians and that they're only going to have a no-fly zone, and then immediately, as you say, and detailed it, expanded it, and it's led to huge numbers of casualties and continues. What about any other hypocrisies that you see in terms of other places that are where there are popular revolts in and the regimes are repressing them, where imperial governments actually support that repression?
Sure. Well, maybe we could just start with the hypocrisy of Canadian oil politics. Your last guest was talking about the movement against the Keystone Pipeline, which is carrying tar sands oil. So there's been this effort to rehabilitate tar sands oil, which we all know is contributing massively to climate change, by calling it ethical oil, because somehow oil from Canada is more ethical to burn and put into the atmosphere than oil from other countries. Well, one of the main exploiters of tar sands oil is Suncor, formerly Petro-Canada, a big Canadian oil company that works in the tar sands. Well, Suncor has also been active in both Libya and Syria. So there's a huge hypocrisy right there. In 2004, the former Liberal government did all kinds of dirty and cynical, hypocritical dealings with Gaddafi in order to win contracts for Suncor to exploit Libya's oil. And then if we look over to Syria, where possibly as many as 2,000 people have died in recent months at the hands of the regime suppressing this uprising, Suncor's operations in Syria have continued. The oil has continued to flow, and Suncor has kept going there without any serious move by the Canadian government to punish this company. So so-called ethical oil is behaving unethically in Libya, Syria, and here in Canada. So that's number one hypocrisy. And then we can also think about the other places where there have been uprisings that the Canadian government has either ignored Or directly supported the oppressors, the regimes that are suppressing these uprisings. I guess the Yemen is one example, but another very important example is Bahrain, because it was a matter of days between the NATO intervention in Libya and the passage of the UN resolution. Just sort of in that same week, I forget the exact details, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states sent in an armed force into Bahrain to help the Bahrainian regime massacre this incredible democratic uprising. And they actually tore down the central square and landmark of Bahrain, the Pearl. This most important landmark in the country, which had become a rallying point for the protests, was torn down. It reminded me a bit of the Taliban blowing up the Buddhas, the statues of Buddha, the Buddha statues. And this was covered all over the world, but the destruction of the Pearl of Bahrain was completely ignored. The Canadian government made no protest in support of the Bahraini democracy movement. And so, you know, we have a short segment here, so we can't list all the hypocrisies, but there's countless other regimes where Canadian corporations are working in collaboration with dictatorships and profiting off of very serious human rights violations. And the Harper government goes to bat for those corporate interests, not for the people's human rights in those countries.
Well, let's look at the political situation here in Canada and the role played by Harper.
Well, Harper was over there about a week ago, just before he went to Paris, where they had the conference to sort of carve up the spoils of war in Libya. The NATO powers met in Paris. And just before that, Harper flew to Italy to thank the Canadian troops and the fighter jet pilots who had run so many missions over Libya as part of this NATO bombing. And, you know, he went very over the top. This is now a majority prime minister. Who's really all along these last 5 years been basically unopposed in his foreign policy, but now I think he feels totally without a serious opposition on foreign policy. So he was very bombastic in his rhetoric. He talked about how, you know, Canada is punching above its weight, but, you know, before we could do that, we had to learn how to punch. He talked about how thugs like, or regimes like Gaddafi don't understand the force of arguments, they only understand the argument of force. And you could read his remarks in Italy to the Canadian troops as a call to intervene wherever Canada and NATO felt like it to overthrow a regime they didn't agree with. So this is a very serious potential precedent. And, you know, as you say, there's already talk about Syria, but there's also just sort of a broader revival of this idea of military intervention by the Western powers being okay. In a way, they're trying to use Libya to overcome the Iraq syndrome. Just as in the past, the Western powers were sort of held back by what was known as the Vietnam syndrome, that is just popular revulsion about these imperialist wars. So too now, I think they have a bit of an Iraq syndrome because that war is so understood to be a disaster based on lies. And I think they're really trying to use this moment around Libya to re-legitimize the idea of military intervention. And their triumphalism is way, way early, because as I say, there's a lot of factors still at play in Libya. There's a lot of fighting going on. And as we've seen in the past, overthrowing the regime in power is often the easy part for the imperialists. The hard part is establishing a stable regime in their interests. And, you know, by no means do I think that they're assured of being able to do that in Libya. I think the Libyan people, you know, still have the ability to say no, to push back against foreign interference and to try to carve out their own destiny in this post-Gaddafi era. And I think that's what we have to focus on as an anti-war movement, is to really say, regardless, I think in some sense, regardless of our debates over the no-fly zone issue months ago, we can now unite and say, you know, Libya for the Libyans, there should be no military bases, no troops on the ground, and no political and corporate interference in the constitution of a new Libyan government.
So we have Harper, and certainly some people would, of our listeners for sure, would expect that kind of rhetoric. But what about Canadians like Lloyd Axworthy? He's former foreign minister under the Liberals. He's been central in pushing the United Nations to adopt imperial intervention under the guise of a humanitarian rationale. Has Lloyd Axworthy commented on these Libyan developments and NATO's involvement?
It's Axworthy, as you might know, is now retired, both from his job at the University of Manitoba or Winnipeg, and as a politician. But he has very much been active and working hard these last 6 months, publishing quite frequently in favor of the war in Libya. And recently being quite triumphalist himself, saying that Libya has legitimized again this responsibility to protect. And as you say, Axworthy and the Canadian government, successive Canadian governments, played a very key role in pushing through this notion of responsibility to protect right through the UN. Actually, it was Michael Ignatieff played a key role as well on some of the commissions that helped to draft this. So this is really an Axworthy, Ignatieff, maybe Paul Martin doctrine that has been pushed through the United Nations. So Axworthy has made a big comeback saying that Libya legitimizes this idea. And there's layers of ironies and things to be critical about there. But one I wanted to note was that one of the first instances of intervention that was justified by this notion of responsibility to protect was the coup in Haiti in 2004, which happened under the watch of Liberal Prime Minister Paul Martin. They sort of quickly put away this rationale because things went so badly after the coup and there were so many massacres of the supporters of the overthrown democratic government in Haiti. But in early 2004, they talked about responsibility to protect in Haiti. And then later in 2004 was when Paul Martin was over in Tripoli, flattering Gaddafi to get these oil contracts for Suncor and normalizing relations with the Gaddafi regime. So it's actually these same people who are now using Libya to re-legitimize the idea of military intervention. They're the exact same people in Canada's political life who made all kinds of dirty deals and business deals with the Gaddafi regime. Yeah, we can go on about the hypocrisies of the former Liberal government, but I guess that's less of a pressing concern for those of us organizing now with a Harper majority government that's becoming more and more bellicose. But all of it just shows how ill-served we are, even by our political opposition in Ottawa, when it comes to challenging foreign policy.
And is there any hope you have that this might be challenged by the NDP? They voted. Everybody voted except Elizabeth May of the Green Party for the extension of Canadian involvement in Libya. Harper's now talking of needing, of course, further extension of that and continuing Canadian intervention. Is this causing any ripples, do you think, in NDP circles?
I hope so. I hope it's causing a lot of ripples, but it's hard to say. We should at least say that the NDP has said there should be no additional extension of the Canadian military mission, something Harper has made clear he's going to do quite quickly when Parliament reconvenes next week. So hopefully there'll be some strong statements in the House of Commons, although we can't really hold our breath given the recent track record. And part of it is this responsibility to protect. It's really gone across partisan lines. I was so happy to see that at least Elizabeth May had stood up and opposed the extension of the war a couple months back there. She was literally the only person voting against this, otherwise it would have been unanimous. But then I went and read Elizabeth May's speech, and she actually talks about the responsibility to protect doctrine, how she agreed with it, but in this case it didn't apply or something. So, in a way it's just a phrase, it's just a buzzword, some bureaucratic jargon, but it has very real implications, and it was very consciously developed to give a sort of veneer of legitimacy to what, the Bush administration did this very vulgarly with Iraq, and it backfired and blew up in their face. The other track of imperialist intervention, the Liberal effort spearheaded by Axworthy, was an effort to do this with a more benign face. And Paul Martin, in his memoir, I believe he actually talks about how Canada was uniquely positioned. I don't know if this is not a verbatim Paul Martin, but he says in his memoir how Canada was the natural country to push this responsibility to protect because we're perceived to have clean hands. he actually sort of said it's a perception that we have clean hands, so it's easier for us to stick our hand in Haiti or you know, to do the work of pushing this responsibility to protect doctrine. So unfortunately, we have a lot of educational work to do so that, you know, Green members of Parliament and NDP members of Parliament and even Liberals, you know, understand what this doctrine really means, and that it's just a fig leaf for sort of naked aggression in foreign policy, which is really, when you strip it all down, that's what Libya is, just another example of aggressive foreign policy. And I think Libyans are gonna start to see this more themselves. That we've already heard of many tragedies or you know, accidents where NATO bombs a convoy of rebels, and I have no doubt that the Libyans, even those who had a lot of hope in what NATO was doing, many of them will turn against NATO when they see what's really being cooked up for post-Gaddafi Libya.
Thank you very much, Derek.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Derek O'Keefe. He's co-author with Malalai Joya of the book A Woman Among Warlords on Malalai's life experience in Afghanistan, and he's author of a forthcoming book, Michael Ignatieff, The Lesser Evil. Derek also is co-chair of the Canadian Peace Alliance.